And it is a great occasion. I love baptisms. I don't know, something about a baptism that speaks to me, as well as just the significant event that it is in that person's life. I think it's an opportunity for all of us to renew our commitment as we see someone taking that step. I don't know whether we got a picture up there. Yep, all good. Interesting, I was just reading this morning, I think it was, that Harvard University, has determined that in their research that PowerPoint presentations are worse than useless. So I almost scrapped it, but then I thought Harvard University also says that creation is a myth. So I thought, no, I'm going to stick with it for a while. Well, we're having a little mini-series called Flawed Heroes. And Sam asked me if I would look at Moses. And as you've already heard, Jerome is going to look at his older sister Miriam next week. So I'm excited to hear about that as well. I think Jerome's well on the way. I hope he's well on the way with that anyway. And he's going to share with us something about Miriam. There's a lot less said about Miriam than there is about Moses, that's for sure. So I guess I got the long straw here. Well, first of all, perhaps just, we haven't got time. We've got 120 years to condense into 35 minutes or whatever we've got. So we've got to really fly through. Last week, Chris started off his sermon with a spoiler. Well, I'm going to tell you that all I've got today is teasers, because we're just going to skip through a few points. And if you don't know much about the story of Moses already, you might be a bit lost, but you could catch up. And I would suggest that if you want to refresh yourself on the story of Moses, read Exodus chapter 1 and just read through, even if you just get to chapter 14. I don't mean now, I mean, you know, when you go home. And you'll get a good background to the story of Moses from Exodus chapter 1 through to chapter 14 of Exodus. So there's just a little bit of a family tree. His parents were Amram and Jochebed, and he had an older sister called Miriam. We don't know how old she was, but she was obviously quite a few years older by the context of how things eventuated. Aaron, we know, was 3 years older than Moses. He married a woman called Zipporah when he fled to Midian. And although the Bible doesn't talk about it, Josephus, who was a first century Jewish historian, he claimed that Moses had married a princess from Ethiopia, an Ethiopian princess, when he was leading the army, the Egyptian armies, against the Ethiopians. And they fell in love and married. So that's not in the Bible, that's just Josephus, how he records things. And so we're not going to put a lot of credibility on that, because he was a bit of a turncoat. When things were suitable, he joined the Romans and became an interpreter and a historian for the Romans. So, yeah, he had things to gain for his own benefit. Moses and Zipporah had two boys called Gershom and Eleazar. Bit of an overview of his life. As I said, 120 years. He was born in a slave family in Egypt, in approximately, according to Jewish records, 1392 BC. And then he was 40 years in Egypt. Then he flees to Midian. 40 years in Midian. He encounters God in the burning bush. And then he has 40 years in the wilderness, and eventually dies and is buried by God on Mount Nebo in Moab, according to the end of Deuteronomy. So there's just a little bit of an overview, a little bit of background. As I said, if you want to get some good, solid biblical background, read Exodus 1 through to 14. Now, I thought if we're talking about flawed heroes, we better determine, first of all, that he was indeed a hero. And so I'm just going to read to you a few verses from Scripture, various passages, and I'll do this quickly. Don't you bother looking it up. I'll just read some extracts that determine and show us clearly that certainly in God's view, Moses was a hero. He was certainly a great hero for the Jewish people, and we would say he was a great hero today. So these are some verses. Deuteronomy 34, 5 to 7 says, "So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died, and his eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. Then verses 10 to 12 of Deuteronomy 34, and there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. Numbers 12, verse 3. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. Stephen's address in Acts chapter 7, verse 22. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. And then later on in that same address by Stephen, chapter 7, verse 35 to 36, this Moses, whom they rejected, that is his country people who were in slavery at that time, this Moses whom they rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge? This man God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. We come over to Hebrews, that great chapter that records so many heroes of the faith, verses 24 to 28. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch him. We could go on with other references. There's one in Revelation chapter 15, verses 2 to 3, where we see the people in heaven singing the song of Moses and of the Lamb. We could think about the transfiguration when Moses appeared with Elijah on the mountain with Jesus, speaking about his death that was to come. So I think we can see that Moses is indeed a hero in the Bible, presented to us in that light. And it would be nice if we could just leave it there, wouldn't it? We could say, wow, what a man. What a man of God. And he was indeed. But as is the custom, God does not shy away from our failures in recording human history. And so we find that the flaws of men like Moses and Elijah and David and so on, they are given to us. It's a warts and all biography of these great heroes. We might ask, why would that be? Well, we don't have to wonder, because the Bible actually tells us why they're recorded. In fact, this is what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 11 and 12. Now these things happened to them as an example. And it's talking about the children of Israel in particular here. But they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. So why were these flaws recorded in these great men and women of God? Why were the flaws recorded? They were written down for our instruction. And then verse 12 says, therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. Could this great man, Moses, do anything wrong? Could this man who was so close to God and who spoke face to face with God, like no other prophet ever did? Could this great hero of the faith ever fall, ever fail? Yes, they did. And we're going to look at that this morning. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. So I want to look at four incidents in the life of Moses that show his shortcomings, his failures, the flaws. First of all, we want to see that he was deluded by his credentials. Second, he was daunted by his calling. Then we find an incident where he was depressed by circumstances. And can you believe it? He was even disobedient to God's command. So, as I said, these will just be bits of teasers. We'll be rushing through these and keeping the readings and the comments as brief as possible. And so, first of all, he was deluded by his credentials. Well, we're going to have a reading in Acts chapter 7. I mentioned that mentioned earlier on that Stephen, in this address, in Acts chapter 7, he recounts the history of Israel, and he actually refers to Moses in verses 23 to 29. So, Acts chapter 7, and we'll read these verses, verse 23 down to verse 29. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. And on the following day he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, you are brothers. Why do you wrong each other?" But the man who was wronging his neighbor thrust him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" At this retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. So Moses has been brought up in the palace. He's been one of the outstanding men in Egypt. If Josephus is right, he actually led the Egyptian army against the Ethiopian invaders and actually repelled them and married their princess. Now, he was a great man. Stephen tells us he was a great man, not only in his words, but in his deeds. He was a strong man. He was well equipped. He had the credentials. He'd been brought up in the pomp and wealth and wisdom of the Egyptian court as Pharaoh's daughter's son, Pharaoh's grandson, a place of honor. Even though he had such humble beginnings as a slave's son. But the interesting thing is that when he goes out, eventually it comes into his heart to go out and see what's happening, what's really happening on the ground with his brothers, his Israelite brothers. And he goes out and he sees an Egyptian giving one of the slaves the hiding of his life. And he looks around and he goes, "I'll fix this." So he got in, hooked into him and killed him, buried him. Next day he goes out and he sees two of the Israelite slaves quarreling, fighting amongst themselves. He says, "Come on, you guys, you're brothers, what are you doing?" And one of them, who's in the wrong, turns to him and says, "Who do you think you are? You're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses, he didn't think anybody saw except maybe God. And of course, Pharaoh got to hear about it. We read in the account back in Exodus, and he was after him to kill him. So he got out of the place and he went to Midian. Now, he had the credentials. But I want to suggest that emotion took over rational thinking. He responded to a situation. Was the situation wrong? Yes, it was. Really, should there have been some intervention? Yes, there needed to be some intervention in this unjust treatment of his fellow Israelite who was a slave. But his emotions took over. And he made a decision. He's a strong man. He's perhaps leader of the army. He's certainly well recognized in Egypt. And he just took things into his own hand. He reacted to a situation. He responded to what he saw in front of him. And he just killed the Egyptian. His emotions took over. I want to suggest to you it was the wrong method. It was the wrong motivation. But most of all, it was the wrong timing. he knew that he had been called. Somehow he knew that he had been called to be a deliverer of his people. Now, whether that was through a prophecy, through his parents, or however it happened, he knew that he was to be the deliverer. And he just thought, well, they'd all know that too. And so he just got in there and started doing it. His emotions took over. It was not a rational decision at all. How stupid is that? In the middle of what's going on, to think that he could get away with killing an Egyptian. He thought he could get away with it. His emotions took over. You know, that happens so often with us, doesn't it? We see something that needs to be sorted out. We need to see something that needs to be done, and we get all emotionally hyped up about it, and we go, well, I've got to do something about this. Of course, that must be done. And we don't stop and rationally think about it. You know, Christians should be able to think rationally. Because Paul tells us in Romans 12 that we are not to be conformed to this world, but we are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And then he goes on to say that by testing you may discern what is the will of God. So it's important that we don't just see a problem that needs to be solved and say, I'm going to solve it. This is my job. And respond emotionally. Rather, we're to think with the mind of Christ, rationally, with the transformed mind, and test to see if that is the will of God, according to Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. And in fact, Paul goes on there to say, when he talks about the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Let me give you a quick illustration. Paul is traveling with his colleague Silas, his missionary colleague Silas, and they're traveling, and he hears about a great need in Asia, a need for the gospel. And I know I talk about this a lot, but I think it's a great example. He says, Asia needs the gospel. And Paul's heart throbbed with a passion to share the love of Christ, the story, the good news of Jesus Christ. And he heard about the great city of Ephesus and the idolatry and the whole province of Asia. And he goes, they need the gospel. And of course they did. Of course they did. But it wasn't God's time. And the Spirit of God stopped him from going there. The same thing happened with Bithynia. He wanted to go to Bithynia and preach the good news. But the Spirit of God stopped him. It wasn't the right time. It was the right thing, but not the right time. And brothers and sisters, we need to be careful in our decision making, that we don't just go all hyper-emotional and leave out the rational thinking of the transformed mind. So often, we do the right thing, but in the wrong way, like Moses did, and in the wrong time, as Moses did. Second, there's the problem of wanting to use my strength rather than God's enabling. As we trace the story of the redemption of Israel, the release from slavery from Egypt, we see that it was God's power that enabled that great exodus. It was not the power of Moses. Moses went in with all his strength, if he was indeed the captain of the army. We know he was a strong man. Stephen tells us that. Later on, when he flees to Midian, there's seven sisters and they're looking after a few sheep for their dad, and the shepherds come along and they drive them away from the water troughs. Moses on his own stands up to the shepherds so that these girls could feed the sheep, could water the sheep. He was a tough man, make no mistake about it. He was no wuss. But he wanted to use his strength, and so he slew the Egyptian. He thought he was going to do it in his own strength. Well, we're very guilty of that. I know I'm terribly guilty of that. I want to do things in my strength instead of allowing God to do it. You know, God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. Oh, that puts a different spin on it, doesn't it? It's when we are weak that we are strong, because then God comes in and does it his way, and he just uses us graciously. So let's be careful about that. That's another lesson that we can learn from Moses. And of course, the outcome of this was rejection. Rejection by his own people. his own brother, I mean fellow Israelite, says to him, "Who do you think you are? You think you're going to rescue us? Get away," pushed him away. Rejected by his own people. But then, of course, he was rejected by the Egyptians. He ended up being a nobody. He was, by blood, he was an Israelite. He'd been brought up for 40 years in all the splendor of Egypt. But now he's a nobody. He's rejected by the Israelites and he's rejected by Egypt. And so he flees to Midian, which is, in the old King James Version, called the backside of the desert. That has great connotations, doesn't it? The backside of the desert. I think it's actually two words, backside of the desert. But it says something different to me. Not a good place. Not a great place to be. And that's where he ended up. A nobody. Looking after a few sheep. Way, way, way over in Midian. Rejection. Well, his credentials really didn't mean much, did they, when he got to Midian? Instead of being the leader of an army, a man of great deeds and great words, a powerful man with influence now, he's married, a couple of boys, a few sheep, 40 years. 40 years he did that. 40 years in the backside of the desert. Well, 40 years comes to a conclusion, and one day he's out with his sheep, and he sees a bush burning. But the bush is not being consumed. And so he goes to have a look. So that's in Exodus chapter 3. So let's go back to Exodus chapter 3. It actually runs right across Exodus chapter 3 and into Exodus chapter 4. But we're not going to be reading very much of it. As I said, I'd suggest that you would find it a very interesting exercise to read the first 14 chapters of Exodus. Most of it's pretty straightforward. There's one funny little bit in there that's a little bit confusing about Zipporah cutting off her son's foreskin and tapping it on Moses' feet. I don't know what that was all about, but anyway, somehow or other he became a blood husband, blood bridegroom through that. So there must be some ritual or something associated with it, a bit of a funny bit, but the rest of it's pretty straightforward. Exodus chapter 3, we'll read a little bit about that here. I'm just going to pick out some verses. Most of you would know this story of the burning bush. The first thing I want you to notice is that when God appears to him and speaks to him, Moses has an inferiority complex. No wonder. No wonder. He's been rejected by his own people 40 years previously. He's been rejected and chased out of Egypt by the Egyptians. And now here he is for 40 years looking after a few sheep in some, to use the world's term, God-forsaken place. Well, it wasn't God-forsaken because there was God in the bush talking to him. But that's what it must have seemed like to Moses. He would have had an inferiority complex, all right, and we see that come out when God tells him, "Moses, actually, you are the man that's going to deliver Israel." And he goes, "Who am I? Who am I?" This wasn't any false humility. This is how he felt. This is very obviously how he felt now. He says, I'm definitely not up to that. I'm just a guy living in the backside of Midian in the desert looking after a few sheep. I'm just a dad with a couple of kids. Who am I that I should go and deliver them? He had an inferiority complex. You get that in verse 11 if you're following it through. The second thing is, when God persisted and said, "No, you're the man to go," he said, well, who am I going to say sent me? Ah, now Moses is starting to twig. He's realizing now that if he is going to do this, he needs to have authority. He needs to have authority. So he says, "Who am I going to say sent me? If I go to the Israelites and say, 'You've told me to come and deliver them,' and they go, 'Who are you again?' I've got to be able to have some authority. Who am I going to say sent me?" God said, "I am. The great I am. The one who has come to you in the burning bush, I am. I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It's the I am, the ever-existent one. It's I am. Tell them I am sent you." And Moses realized he needed authority. Then as the questioning goes on, as the dialogue goes on, he realizes he needs some evidence. And he's still balking at it. He's going, oh, no, 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 no. He said, well, I need some evidence. And God said, okay, I'll give you some evidence. And so there were a few miracles that he performed, like, you know, throwing his staff down on the ground and it turns into a snake, and picking it up again, it goes back into a staff, putting his hand inside his coat and becomes leprous, put it back in again and it becomes clean again. All this stuff's going on. The evidence reminds you of Gideon a bit, doesn't it? Eh? Wanting some evidence. And we're like that. Some people say that's a great measure of faith. I think it's a measure of our lack of faith, isn't it? We can't take God at his word. We've got to sort of get some signs. We need some signs, want some evidence. Well, Moses certainly wanted some evidence. And then we see the need for dependence. As he keeps this dialogue going and God's saying, yeah, you're the man, you're not getting out this easily, Moses, you're the one I'm sending. He says, no, no, who am I? No, who am I? Well, who will I say sent me? I'll need some sort of evidence. And God says, well, and then he says, well, look, I can't even talk. And maybe that was true. Even though Stephen says he was a man who was great in word, that may well have been when he was in Egypt. But he's been talking to sheep for 40 years. He hasn't been standing in the courts of Pharaoh. He hasn't been out as a general leading the army. He's been leading a few sheep around in the wilderness, talking to his boys, talking sweet nothings to Zipporah. And now he's supposed to go and talk to Pharaoh. God says, I'll give you the words to speak. I'll be with your mouth. I made your mouth, after all. I'll be with you. I will give you the words to speak. There was this sense then of dependence. God is saying, I will be there. I'm dependable. I will be there for you. I'll be there with you. I'll even give you the words to speak. Well, Moses is still not beat. In desperation, he's lost the argument, as you always do with God. He's lost the argument, so he just says, oh, send somebody else. Just send somebody else. Well, God got a bit angry at that stage. God had been working along with him nicely all the way, but now God gets angry. He was very upset with Moses. He said, all right. He said, I'll give you your brother Aaron. And Aaron, you will speak to my words to Aaron, and he will speak for you. So he'll be your mouthpiece. And so that was the desperation that Moses came to. He just could not get out of it. Well, I don't know whether there's any lessons in that for us, but maybe as we just skim through it, maybe you've picked up something that's helpful to you there as we work through that. Have we lost it? Okay, well, you just have to listen, won't you? Maybe that's a sign, eh? Okay, depressed by circumstances, let us not go there. Here we come to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. Now they've been on the journey, on the way to Canaan, the promised land, for a long time now, quite a while, and they've just had some amazing experiences when we get to Numbers chapter 11. When we get to Numbers chapter 11, they have been camped at Sinai, Mount Sinai, for about a year. So from Exodus chapter 19, right back to Exodus chapter 19, up to Numbers chapter 10 and verse 11, all that time they're camped at Sinai. So it's a period of about a year. And during that time they've received the law, the moral, ceremonial and civil law from God. The instructions for the tabernacle have been given to Moses. The tabernacle has been built. The priesthood has been established. The issue of the idolatry with the golden calf has been settled, and many people had been killed, and that had all been sorted out. And now it's time to move on. And when we come to chapter 11, we find they're prepared to move on. Sorry, chapter 10 and verse 11. It says, in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, after being there for a year. We come to chapter 11, and they've only been on the journey 3 days. And they complain again. They have seen the awesome sight just a little while previous of Moses going up the mountain, coming down the mountain, and his face shining so much so that he had to cover it or the people couldn't look at him. They'd heard the thunderings and the ram horns being blown and the instructions that no man or beast must touch the mountain or they would be killed. They'd seen the awesome holiness of an incredible God. And 3 days later, they complain. Now, this is deja vu for Moses. You might remember that it was only 3 days after they'd crossed the Red Sea, the miracle of crossing the Red Sea on dry land. 3 days after, when they came to Marah and the water was bitter, the people complained. Just 3 days after marching through the Red Sea on dry land. And now 3 days after seeing the wonders of Sinai and hearing the law and seeing the tabernacle erected and the cloud coming down as the evidence of the presence of God, and now 3 days after all of that, they're complaining again. Let's just read here in chapter 11 to try and get a bit of a picture of Moses' depression. Now we'll read from verse 10. Chapter 11, verse 10. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me?" Notice all the personal pronouns. Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, "Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give their fathers"? Where am I to get meat to give all this people? They were complaining about they only had manna to eat and they wanted some meat. For they weep before me and say, "Give us meat that we may eat. I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once, if I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." There's a man in deep depression. Frustration has caused him to spiral down into depression, even to the extent where he's suicidal. Frustration, depression, suicidal. This is Moses. This is the hero, the great man of God. There's an inability to think, feel, or act rationally. He said some really stupid things there when you really stop and think about it, if you think rationally about it. Let me go through them. They're not up there for you, so I'll try and emphasize them for you. In verse 12, we see that he forgot God's plan. He forgot that God had a big plan. In the heat of the moment, in the pressure of the present, he forgot that God had a big plan. God had a destination for these people. God had a big plan and Moses forgot it. He forgot God's promises. God had told him, "I will be with you. I will bring this people into the land." Moses didn't have to carry them. God said, "I will bear them on eagle wings." Moses didn't have to do that. He didn't have to carry them. This was God's job. Moses forgot God's plan and he forgot God's promises and he forgot God's power. Because then, we didn't read it, but a bit further on in the chapter, Moses, when God sort of convinces him that he can sort of supply meat, Moses says, "Come on. If we kill all the animals around everywhere, there won't be enough meat to feed these people for a month. If you killed all the fish in the sea, there wouldn't be enough meat to feed this multitude, 600,000 people for a month," as God had said. And I'll just read the verse. Verse 21 of chapter 11. "But Moses said, 'The people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot, and you have said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them? And the Lord said to Moses, you see, he'd forgotten God's power. The Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Oh, Moses had forgotten the power of the Lord. He'd forgotten the power of the one who could send manna to cover the fields, the one who had provided sweet water out of bitter water, the one who had provided water out of a rock. He'd forgotten the power. And here he is in the depths of depression. Now, I know a lot of people suffer with depression, and some more or less. A few things that can cause depression. One is guilt. Can be guilt. And it could be sin that we've committed. And as a result of that sin, we carry guilt. And it causes us to spiral down into depression. That's one possibility. It could be physiological. It could be hormones out of whack. That can cause it for one reason or another. Or it could be stress, as was the case with Moses. He was under a tremendous load and he felt the stress and the load of this great number of people, 600,000 people who were moaning and complaining. And just a few days earlier, he had been full of optimism. As they left Sinai, he says, oh, mighty God, let us go forth. He's crying out like this, stuff like that at the end of chapter 10. And now he's in the depth of depression just a few days later. The stress of circumstances had weighed heavily upon him to the extent where he says, Lord, you could just kill me if you like. I'd like to be out here. I don't want to live as wretched as I am. I don't want to go on. And maybe some of you have been there. You know, a friend of mine who went through a period of deep depression, I remember him saying to me, you know, I didn't really feel like reading the Bible, but I just knew I just had to keep reading the Bible. And he just kept reading the Bible. He just kept there. Sometimes it didn't mean much to him. Sometimes he didn't feel like doing it. Sometimes it was just like a blank page. Didn't seem to say anything. But he decided that that's what he was going to do. What a good thing that was. What a good thing. To get a perspective back with God. Get a perspective with God. Well, we better hoot along, hadn't we? The final thing we have is disobedient to God's command. And here we come over to Numbers chapter 20. If you want to just flick over the few pages to Numbers chapter 20, and we'll finish off very shortly. Numbers chapter 20, we find the beginning of the chapter. Miriam, Moses' older sister, has died. She dies there in the wilderness of Zin. And then just shortly after that, they come to Meribah, where there's no water. Not Meribah, Meribah, where there's no water. And so God says to Moses in verse 8 of chapter 20, take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water, so you shall bring water out of the rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle. And Moses took the staff from before the Lord as he commanded him. All good so far, all right? He's being obedient. He's doing exactly what God said. He took the staff as he was commanded. Now it starts to go pear-shaped. Verse 10. Then Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels. God had called them a congregation. He calls them, you rebels. Shall we bring water for you? Shall we bring water for you out of this rock? Oh, things aren't looking good, are they? And Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice. What did God say? Tell the rock. Tell the rock to produce water. And Moses, in his anger, gets the staff of the Lord and he strikes. I'm suggesting it wasn't a couple of little taps. He struck the rock twice, but God graciously still provided water. Water came out abundantly and the congregation drank and their livestock. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe in me to uphold me as holy in the eyes of the people of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them. These are the waters of Meribah, where the people of Israel quarrel with the Lord, and through them he showed himself holy. And so, the points I want to make here are simply these. He had disrespect for God's people. God said, bring the congregation together. We got them together. He said, you rebels! He had uncontrolled anger. God said, tell the rock to produce water. He struck the rock twice with his rod. It was self-promotion. Shall we provide water for you? And the fourth point I want to make is that we're never too old to sin. He's 120 years old, thereabouts. All that he'd experienced of God, all that he'd experienced talking with God face to face, having privileges that no other prophet ever had, proving God's faithfulness throughout the years. But now, in disbelief, he fails. And consequently did not enter the land. He was slain by God and buried by God on Mount Nebo in Moab. We read earlier on, didn't we? Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall. We need to be praying, no matter what age we are, that we will stay faithful to the end. Should we reach old age, that we will remain faithful. That we will still serve God in the capacity that he gives us. I knew a man who used to pray, Lord, right throughout his life, Lord, may I not be a silly old man. I heard of another man who prayed regularly, Lord, may I not be a dirty old man. And I've known a couple of others that should have prayed that. We need to be aware that even though we may have experienced much of God's power and grace in our lives, let's take heed. There's still the possibility of failure. I don't want to leave you there. I want you to come over to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3 for a few verses here. Because Moses, while he's a hero, is not the hero of Scripture. Israel would put Moses up there with Abraham as a great hero, their great hero of the faith. We have another hero. We find him here in chapter 3, Hebrews chapter 3, and I'll read verses 1 to 6. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in the heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle, the sent one, and the high priest, the one who represents us to God, the high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses. Now, this author is writing to Jewish Christians. So he's sort of careful here. He says, just as Moses was also faithful in all God's household, for Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son. And we are his house if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope. Just quickly. Jesus is presented as the apostle and high priest of our faith. He's the sent one, the one who was sent. He's the envoy that came to bring God's message, to represent God on earth. He's the apostle, the sent one. He's the high priest. He's the one who represents us back to God and makes us acceptable with God through his own sacrifice. And then he goes on to talk about this thing about the house or the household. And of course, the writer explains it. It says, we are that house. The people of God have always been the household. I mean, even the temple or the tabernacle was not really the household of God. It was the people of God, even back in Old Testament times. And certainly today, the church is described as the household of God. Well, Moses was a servant of things to come in God's house. He was faithful, but he was just a servant. But Jesus, he's the son. He's the heir of all things. Not only that, he's the builder of the house. And here's a beautiful picture of the deity of Christ. He's the one who builds the house. It says God builds all things, but Christ is the one who builds it. And so he is worthy of more glory than Moses. For all the wonders of Moses and the great lessons that we can learn from Moses, we have someone who is a greater hero than Moses. There are lessons to learn, there are instructions for us from the life of Moses and even the failures of Moses. But oh, we come to the one who was faultless. We come to the one who never failed. Peter said he did no sin. John said in him was no sin. And this is the one that a little later on we'll be remembering. We'll be remembering the one who was the perfect sacrifice. The Lamb of God without blemish. No flaw or fault in him. Without blemish. Without spot. And we'll remember him today because he's our real hero. Moses, oh, we can learn so much from Moses. There is so much to emulate. There is instruction even from his failures. But brothers and sisters, today, let us lift our minds a little above Moses. Let us think of the one who is worthy of far more glory than Moses, according to Hebrews 3. Let us worship him in spirit and in truth.